This is the story of stores. So, it's early October, 1881.
A man who went by the initials JBO is traveling north to Mansfield with his wife. He writes in the Hartford Courant,
"The approach southward from Willimantic is a good one. It includes 8 miles of travel beyond Willimantic northward through very moderately prosperous farm country." Very moderately prosperous.
High praise.
Anyway, he's heading to the Mansfield Church for a special ceremony.
An opening ceremony.
It was a Friday because he said,
"That was as soon as the people and things were ready."
And he said,
"Science don't know, but what it's as lucky a day as any."
True, gotta love Fridays.
So, who were these people? Why were folks from across the state filing into that church?
Well, they were there for the grand public opening of the store's agricultural school. You might know it better as UConn. Hi, I'm Charlie Smart.
And I'm Helen Steck. I'm a history student at UConn.
And I'm a journalism student. We spent the last few months digging through books, letters, newspaper articles.
All kinds of stuff. All about the history of the University of Connecticut. Hundreds and hundreds of pages.
And in this podcast, we're going to condense all of that information down and give you the real story of UConn.
All the things you probably don't know.
Like, who is that mysterious JBO? More on him later. Let's start at the beginning.
We're in Chuckanaughey's, the restaurant in UConn's Student Union.
You might have been here before. It's named after UConn's founders, Charles and Augustus Storrs.
It was determined that we should name it after their founding fathers.
That's Dennis Pierce, Executive Director of Dining Services.
Chuckanaughey's, that was creative license. They never were known by that. Actually, we went to the family and asked them. You know, we didn't want to, you know, be embarrassed afterwards where we took Charles and Augustus's, you know, and then so we said, "Hey, look, we're thinking of naming it this. Is this okay with you?" And they said yes.
Anyway, in 1663, Samuel Storrs immigrates from Nottinghamshire, England to Barnstable, Massachusetts. In 1698, he moves to Mansfield, Connecticut and starts the Storrs family farm.
Some of UConn's campus is still located on that land.
A few generations later, Augustus Storrs is born in 1817, and his brother Charles Storrs is born in 1822.
They're raised by their parents on the family farm, and, as can be expected of fifth-generation Mansfield farm boys,
they become businessmen in Brooklyn.
In 1850, 28-year-old Charles becomes a partner at a Brooklyn manufacturing firm. When it fails just 4 years later, he assumes its liabilities of $300,000 and pays them off in full.
That's about $8.5 million that he paid back today.
Charles then opens a business
called Storrs Brothers
as a commission merchant with his two brothers, Augustus and Royal.
Though both Charles and Augustus eventually die in New York, Augustus spends his summers on the family farm in Mansfield until his death in 1892.
The men also played a pivotal role in the founding of UConn.
In 1880, Augustus donates 170 acres of land with buildings, including Old Whitney Hall.
That one building was the main building for the school.
That's Betsy Pittman, university archivist at UConn's Dodd Center.
It was the dining hall, it was the library, administrative offices, dormitory housing, classroom space, because everything else was a barn or a shed.
Charles donates $5,000 in cash plus an additional $1,000 soon after for the establishment of an agricultural school in Connecticut.
He also donates 800 volumes from his own private book collection in order to start the school's library.
Funny enough, we actually had some trouble finding these original books in the library today.
We were eventually able to find some of their titles in an old library catalog at the Dodd Center.
Books like
Timber and Timber Trees,
American Farm Book,
Women's Worth and Worthlessness.
That's interesting. A lot of Bibles.
The Fleece and the Loom.
Field Book of
Manures. It was a pretty diverse collection, to say the least.
So, these men grew up on a farm, but they spent most of their lives as businessmen in Brooklyn. Why did they want to help establish an agricultural school in their hometown?
I think they had a sense of community and a tie to the to the area, which has become known as Storrs.
That's Bruce Stave, an emeritus history professor at UConn and author of the most recent history of the school.
Even though they became urban businessmen, they saw their roots in the rural area, and this was a way for them to contribute.
So Charles and Augustus's offer is announced in December 1880 at the Farmers' Convention of the Connecticut Board of Agriculture in New Britain.
A committee of three men, including JBO, investigates the offer.
The report is favorable, and the Storrs brothers' offer is accepted on August 21, 1881, by the Connecticut General Assembly,
thus creating the Storrs Agricultural School. When Augustus and Charles die, they're both buried in a three-acre plot in the northwest corner of Hillside Cemetery.
You know, the one on North Eagleville Road by the chemistry building?
Funny enough, they're the ones who gave the town the deed for the cemetery in 1864.
When the Storrs family donated the cemetery, they requested to be buried on top of the hill.
Apart from everyone else.
Any descendants of the Storrs family can actually still be buried in that family plot.
Just a fun fact.
Anyway, 13 boys are enrolled for the Storrs Agricultural School's first fall term, which began September 28, 1881.
Less than a year after Charles and Augustus made their donation.
The boys have to be at least 15 years old and submit a certificate from their clergyman or member of their local school board.
Basically saying that they're a good kid.
You know, kind of like college admissions today.
Their parents also have to be Connecticut citizens.
And the boys have to take an exam testing their knowledge in reading, writing, grammar, arithmetic, spelling, American history, practical agriculture, and geography.
JBO chronicled the school's opening ceremony in his Hartford Current agricultural column. He wrote, quote,
"Perhaps someone would like to see one of their daily programs. 6:30 a.m., rising bell.
7 a.m., breakfast bell.
8 a.m. to 12 p.m., lectures.
12 p.m., first bell for dinner.
12:15, dinner.
3 to 5 p.m., work.
5:45 p.m., first bell for tea.
6 p.m., tea.
7 to 9 p.m., study. And on Saturdays, work from 9 a.m. to 12 p.m.
By work, JBO meant manual labor, including moving stones.
This was eventually replaced by athletics over the next two decades to the relief of many Storrs students.
However, despite this distaste, most of the school's trustees believed that students needed to be trained in the types of labor that farmers actually had to perform.
So, Bruce Stave, I'm picturing, you know, a bunch of students out in a field standing around a professor, you know, planting a seed in the ground. Is that what the agricultural classes looked like?
Well, I think you hit on it fairly well. I mean, they were watching people doing that. But they also would have lectures about how to plant appropriately, how to be the most efficient kind of farmer, what pricing was like and such. And this was information that would be very useful for them as they go out and set up their businesses.
The school sported three whole faculty members its first year.
The Board of Trustees appointed Solomon Mead of New Haven as principal and Dr. H.P. Armsby as vice principal and professor of agricultural chemistry. Benjamin Franklin Coons was hired as professor of natural history.
Mead only served as principal until 1882, when Dr. Armsby replaced him as acting principal. During the winter term of 1883, Coons was appointed principal. JBO wrote in the Current after originally hiring the professor,
"We have secured the services of Professor B.F. Coons in the Department of Natural History. He is a graduate of Oberlin and our own Scientide School, an excellent disciplinarian and experienced teacher, able to teach anything required."
10 years later, Coons' title was changed to president, making him the first school official to wear that title. He remained in the role until 1898.
Tuition during the first term was only $25 a year, about $600 in today's money.
I wouldn't mind seeing that number on my tuition bill.
Well, the school wasn't exactly the establishment it is today.
It was not a four-year college.
That's Betsy Pittman again.
It was what we would consider now almost vocational. You were taught these specific skills to then go out and employ them.
When the Connecticut General Assembly accepted the Storrs brothers' offer in 1881, their legislative act stated the Storrs School had been established to
educate boys whose parents are citizens of the state in such branches of scientific knowledge as shall tend to increase their proficiency in the business of agriculture.
It was really about maintaining the productivity of agriculture in the state. It was a strong interest in it. It had been a very well-respected profession within the state. All the early settlers were farmers or sea captains. Business came much, much later.
Local organizations like the Connecticut Board of Agriculture stressed the importance of agricultural training and preserving the agricultural way of life as urbanization increased.
The state agreed to establish a school for boys to teach farming, agriculture, animal husbandry, all those skills that were necessary in order to run a profitable agricultural operation.
Following their initial donation, Charles and Augustus weren't very involved in the establishment of the store school.
There was another individual who was very active in agricultural education and politics, and who had the notion that there should be a college to teach scientific agriculture.
That leading individual was Theodore Cedric Gold of Cornwall, Connecticut.
He was instrumental in every aspect of agricultural education and agriculture, agricultural politics in the state in the 19th century. I think he had really the idea to develop the school as a place of scientific agriculture and to lay out a curriculum and such.
Gold was a Yale graduate, and in 1845, he and his father established the Cream Hill Agricultural School in West Cornwall. The school operated until his father's death in 1869.
He was involved with many farming organizations throughout Connecticut, and he and his wife were officers of the Cornwall Grange.
It even met in their house.
When the Connecticut State Board of Agriculture met for the first time in August 1866, Gold was elected secretary, the most influential position on the board.
In short, Theodore Sedgwick Gold was a go-getter, and he really loved farming.
In 1864, he published a pamphlet encouraging the creation of a home for Connecticut orphans of the Civil War.
In 1866, the state of Connecticut opened the orphanage in Mansfield. Gold, unsurprisingly, served as its secretary until the orphanage closed its doors in 1875.
And coincidentally, it became one of the store's agricultural school's first buildings.
An old orphanage? How cheery. Gold was also one of three men entrusted with the organization of the store's agricultural school, and he later served on its first board of trustees.
The second man who helped organize the school was Samuel W. Johnson. He was director of the Connecticut Agricultural Experiment Station from 1877 to 1899, and another member of the school's first board of trustees.
The Experiment Station is a Connecticut state government organization that does scientific research in agriculture and other related fields.
Johnson also played an integral role in recruiting the school's first faculty members.
According to JBO, Johnson, quote, allowed that we have in the state some of the best farmers in the world, able to teach agriculture to those who follow them.
Johnson shared Gold's belief that recent changes in crops and farming methods created the need for schools of agriculture and a new way to train young men.
Johnson reportedly said at the opening ceremony of the store school, quote, we want farmers who have children to educate to remember that this is their school and help us take care of it.
The third and final man tasked with the organization of the school was the person we seem to keep going back to, JBO.
Better known as Luther James Bradford Olcott, a renowned turf farmer from Manchester, Connecticut.
The guy really loved grass.
Most of the letters he wrote rambled for pages about the topic.
He even pasted samples of grass to some of them.
He even had the Kellogg brothers of Hartford make professional prints of some of the specimens from his turf garden in Manchester.
Seriously, you can still see them at the Connecticut State Library. It's just pages and pages of pictures of different kinds of grass.
Olcott owned a turf farm in South Manchester and wrote an agricultural column for the Hartford Courant.
He was appointed to the 1880 committee that examined the Storrs brothers' donation to develop what became the Storrs Agricultural School.
And following the school's establishment, he was invited to sit on the first board of trustees.
He was considered one of the best authorities on grass in his time, and he was frequently consulted about turf-related matters. He helped out with Brooklyn's Prospect Park and Central Park in New York City.
Olkit, along with Johnson and Gold, played a pivotal role in the early years of the store school.
They were involved in almost the daily operation of what was going on campus. How much faculty got paid, who should be hired, whether a new barn should be constructed, whether the barn got moved. And so it was this twining of their personal interests and their profession.
So in 1891, 10 years after its opening, 63 students are enrolled at the school.
In 1889, the Connecticut General Assembly provides $50,000, which goes towards the construction of the main building and Gold Hall, a 30-room dormitory named after, who would have guessed?
Theodore Sedgwick Gold.
Progress at the store's agricultural school may have continued slowly yet steadily if it weren't for something called the Yale Stores controversy.
But that's a story for next time. The Story of Stores is a production of WHUS Radio at the University of Connecticut. It is produced by Helen Steck and me, Charlie Smart. Special thanks to Dennis Pierce, Betsy Pittman, and Bruce Stave. Music for this episode was provided by Kevin McLeod, Broke for Free, Twin Musicom, Huma Huma, John Kirsch, and Silent Partner. You can tweet at us. I'm at Charlie R. Smart.
And I'm at H. Steck. We'd love to hear your thoughts, comments, or ideas for new episodes. If you like this podcast, please rate it and subscribe on iTunes.
We'll be back in 2 weeks with a new episode, so if you subscribe on iTunes, you'll get it automatically.
Next time on The Story of Stores.
The farmers determined that, Yale wasn't graduating very many farmers.
You know, there wasn't much really that Yale could do by the 1890s. Then it turned to an issue of damages in the court.